You know, it's one of those things where we planned extensively for discussing this movie, as you should always do when you plan extensively for things for years, years and years. And it really pays off in the final product, because
you're just coming right out of the gate with it, aren't
it's
you?
It's a 3-hour movie. Might as well get started.
It's
I know it's slightly under 3 hours, but whatever. It feels like it's
no, but
three.
It's really long. But then, like, at the same time, it doesn't feel like how do they take up 2 hours and 41 minutes?
With a lot of shots of jungle foliage.
I mean, there are a lot of shots of a lot of things. There was a point in this movie where I found myself in the position that I hate to find myself in, where I was watching a scene going like, all right, I would have cut the first 3 seconds off of that shot, and then that one, and then that mm-hmm. one. And I was just like, boy, this didn't have to be this long. I mean, you know, for the 3D spectacle of it all, I guess it was fine, because people enjoyed the 3D.
Did they? I don't know. I feel like a lot of people thought it was novel.
I think they did, but that's... I think that's going to be our big contentious point here, is that you didn't see it in the mm-hmm. theater in the 3D, and I saw it in the theater in the 3D, and it changes the way you view the movie.
Yeah, I would imagine so. And this is one of the reasons why seeing movies in the cinema is such an important thing that the National Association of Broadcasters doesn't want us to lose.
Yeah, that's exactly why, because you have a legendary filmmaker who's going to spend 15, 20 years making, I don't know, what, five movies in Blue World?
Well, see, they have, what is it? They have 2 and 3 ready to go, so that's the first three. But then he has the scripts and stuff for 4 and 5 ready to go just as soon as Fox pulls the trigger.
Right. When you say 2 and 3 are ready to go, what stage of production are they?
In production, as far as I know.
Right. They're shooting, though. They're not like they didn't wrap. I guess you wouldn't call it principal photography. You would call it motion capture, or whatever.
Yeah,
you
call
right?
it being on a soundstage in Marina Del Rey, I think.
are they still doing it in Marina Del Rey? I thought they tore that one down.
I don't know. Maybe I had assumed, because that was the original spot. I knew somebody who worked on Previs for the first one, and it was a lot of hours for a long time for him. They used
Motion Builder on this, didn't they? The thing that comes with Maya.
I think so. Motion Builder is very friendly for Previs, apparently, and flexible for those purposes. So it lets you quickly put together whatever the heck you're going to see, with a lot of, temporary assets, so you can get an idea of what it will be when it finally goes to Weta or, for a couple shots ILM.
Is Weta the one who did most of it?
Weta did the bulk of this, and then ILM, did the, flying human vehicle stuff, in that final battle. And things they did the evil space shuttle and the oversized helicarrier from Aliens,
the lumpy bomber.
Yeah, the lumpy bomber. I'm not a huge fan of the lumpy bomber. It is just such an overinflation of an idea that was already overinflated, because in Aliens you had the drop ship, and it had the wings that fold out with a ridiculous number of missiles, and you're just looking at this thing that is obviously a cartoon of our American fascination with warfare and the devices of warfare. And so then this is like, yeah, well, I'm gonna, you know, hold my beer. This is going to take it to the 10th level, because there's like 6 stacked missile launchers on either side in like a stair-step fashion, along with several rotating spinning blades and thruster jets and everything. It's just like, what an amazingly overly complicated piece of engineering to put together to have this ridiculous vehicle. And the only thing that could be more ridiculous is the evil space shuttle.
First of all, I have to commend you on the GIF you just tweeted. I have never seen that before, but that's Amazing. Would you like to describe it, or would you like me to describe it?
You go ahead, Dan.
It is a ring of Smurfs holding hands, dancing around in a circle around Gargamel and Gargamel's cat, who are tied to the ground with ropes and stakes. And it very much looks like, you know, the AWA ceremony mm-hmm. thing. Oh my goodness, that gave me a good chuckle right there.
Yeah, no, I just I'm not the first person to make a comparison to the Smurfs, nor will I be the last.
Oh, sure.
Because
it was heavily featured as a joke in your favorite movie, Detention.
Oh yes, how could I forget? But I mean, it's also made, people compare it to Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest, which is a very low budget. animated movie from the mid-early 90s that features Tim Curry as the voice of a villain that is apparently toxic waste. There's a good musical number for that. But that also features basically a fairy that befriends a human being, and they work against this giant mechanical combine that is going to turn the rainforest into wood, which is not necessarily how any of that works exactly, especially since they chose to make all the main bad guy characters all white men from somewhere in America, and we don't have a tremendous number of rainforests here north of the equator and the tropics and everything, but whatever. That doesn't seem to stop anybody, but That movie also has a very similar thing of a classic trope of the white guy who comes in, doesn't know anything about a culture, saves the culture, gets the primary female leadership person to be his love interest.
There are a couple of moments in the storyline of this movie that are glossed over very quickly. Which, if we're provided any scrutiny, would be would unravel the majority of the plot here. The main one, based on what you were just describing, there is when Neytiri brings him back after not killing him because of the AWA jellyfish or whatever say don't kill him, and then like everyone's like, ah, these things aren't allowed here, and then Neytiri's mom is like, hang on a second. And then, like, looks him up and down and tastes his blood, which is a little weird. And then she just goes, like, all right, Neytiri, you're going to teach this thing everything about our culture. And then we're gonna see how he does. And it's like, wait, why? And then, obviously, that's going to, you know, put them in close proximity and have them bond. And then, you know, he's going to fall in love with Herod, et cetera, et cetera. But, like, that little decision right there. I guess is buried under the guise of what Neytiri's dad, I don't know his name, said this is the first warrior sky person thing that they sent us, and that's new. We should study it and find out what they want or whatever. It's like, let's study it like it's, I don't know, like a fungus or something. Like, no, it's pretty clear. They want you to leave. They want to dig up your ground. Like, what do you need to study? They're jerks.
Yeah, they're awfully trusting in that moment.
We must teach it all of our secrets and institutional wisdom, and then we can see how it reacts, and then we can learn from it. Like, wait, what? No, that you're gonna teach it your stuff, and then that's how you study it. There's so much that is just like so much hand waviness under the umbrella of just like, oh, we are simple folk who live one with nature and yada yada, and like that's, you know, we are a warrior culture and we start there and then believe in spiritual things, and if you can do that too, then we will accept you.
Yeah, I also like have some question marks around warrior culture that is one with nature and doesn't want to kill anybody. Because those seem to be at odds, and there.
Yeah, this movie is like, it's like 300. You got your Spartans, but also they love nature.
Yeah, because they also have the clans, who are presumably the only other entities, political or otherwise, that they would be going to war with. up until the humans arrive. So,
or is the implication that nature is just so violent that you have to be a warrior in order to defend yourself? Although if you're in harmony with nature, theoretically nature wouldn't attack you, and you wouldn't have to kill it because it's very sad to kill nature. Don't say thank you for killing the six-legged demon dogs or whatever. Just like, you know, if you were more in tune with nature or whatever, they wouldn't have tried to attack you.
Well, but also they do eat meat and they do hunt.
Yeah, I was just about to say, what do the Na'vi eat? We got the scene where the fluffy-headed horse thing or whatever, Jake killed it and said, you know, your body will be fed to the people, but your spirit will go to
Awa.
Or whatever.
A pass to Awa or something like that, and he says it all in Na'vi, and Neytiri is so wowed by this. Thank you for doing our hunting prayer correctly. You are truly one of us now.
Right, exactly. Repetition. You just got to know the words, and you're good.
Hey, Gavalt. Anyway, this movie starts with space and a voiceover. And the voiceover's bad. As we have said previously in another James Cameron film, the voiceover is probably his least skillful use of delivering any sort of exposition. And
are you talking about Terminator 2?
Yeah.
Oh God, it's way worse here.
Well, I know, but I mean, this is just sort of a trend. He's not ever demonstrated that he has improved in knowing how to do a voiceover. That it is just for clunky explanations of things.
It's almost like he started the movie with voiceover, and it was all quiet and whispery and inside your head, which is it sounded like Sin City to me, for one. And then after he did that, he's like, well, the voiceover is really quiet and whispery, so maybe we should have every character whisper through the entire movie too, even though there's no way anyone would be able to hear each other.
Oh, Giovanni Ribisi can't whisper, that's for sure.
Well, Giovanni, amazingly, he cannot whisper, but he also can't open his mouth all the way.
No, or close it, or talk.
So it's just perpetually just like a quarter of an inch open, and he's being very loud.
Well, chewing gum will do that, I suppose. But we'll get to him. But
did I ever tell you some drunk lady at bar swore that I looked just like Giovanni Ribisi one time?
Wow, she must have been really drunk.
She was really drunk. She was this older drunk lady. She was staring at me across from across the bar, and man is like, what is wrong with this lady? She came over. She's like, I'm sorry, I just have to tell you, you look just like Giovanni Ribisi. I'm like, what? No, I don't. Have you seen Giovanni Ribisi?
Maybe she's... Yeah, she was... You should have called, like... a taxi for her. So at the beginning of this, the voiceover is just so bad, and you're like, oh, well, maybe they're just talking over the space scene. No, it just keeps going. And he's just talking over all kinds of stuff in the first act of this film. And it's just like, yeah, you know, I don't have use of my legs because of this thing, but I had a twin brother, and so I'm perfect for this program, they tell me, because I'm the twin brother. And so I'm going to breathe and pause every now and then in my monotone delivery, and also kind of whisper a little bit. And so that's how I'm going to deliver everything.
Oh, God, I just realized it's not Sin City. It's Rorschach.
Oh.
He's doing a little bit of a Rorschach.
Oh. And I'll whisper now. But so anyway, he's a different blue guy in that movie, though. But they had a...
Why is everybody blue? There are other colors in it.
Yeah, there's a lot of blue people in films, and I've worked on several. But not any Na'vi. The thing here is that we get this really clumsy, horrible delivery of how they need to mine some stuff off this planet, and there's native life there, and they have an avatar program where they make these bodies where you can link up, and then some mugger, murdered his brother, who's an identical twin, so he can still be in this program, but his brother had legs and was a scientist. His brother had functioning legs. Sam Worthington has suffered a horrible injury in the wars he was fighting in Venezuela, I believe it was, and so he has a disability, and they treat that very strangely in this film, I have to say. He comes off as sort of an after school special stereotype of not wanting any help at certain moments of the film, and like I don't know. It just doesn't seem entirely sensitive or sincere in it.
No, because like he doesn't have to come to terms with his injury because all it takes is money to get yourself fixed, and like he mentions that, but you know, not on a grunt salary or whatever. And then the deal that's made with bad guy Mick Scratchy Face is that he's going to get his legs back if he snitches on the natives for him.
Yeah, and that's just, it's so dumb. So we get the orbiter drops them off at the base where they've been working, and then the bad guy from Grandma's Boy is there. I forgot his name.
He's not a robot this time.
Tell me, JV, how much do clothes cost in the Matrix? So
you don't even need clothes when you're a Na'vi. You just wear a little loincloth. Yeah.
He's in this movie, which is an interesting casting choice. And
he fits the role of snobby nerd wannabe scientist guy pretty well.
Yeah, but
oh, he forgot his pack on the ship because he's just so overwhelmed and he's not used to missions because he's just a lab rat scientist study guy.
Yeah. And that is, again, of course, the poorly drawn character in a series of poorly drawn characters that we've been introduced to in, what, 5 minutes of this film? We get the very bristly, brusque Grace, who is played by Sigourney Weaver, who is basically just Ripley, and except she's a scientist. So she's sort of like, I guess, her Ghostbusters character crossed with her Aliens character.
Yeah, she's got an edge, though, because she curses and smokes and stuff.
I don't understand the smoking thing. It was a weird affectation. It was weird in Aliens, and it's weird here, too. But yeah, she's smoking indoors in their special thing. We also get treated to all the exposition about the atmosphere outside and blah, 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 blah. And they are gonna suit him up in the Avatar things to do the stuff, and Grace is all upset about this, and so she goes straight to Giovanni Ribisi and interrupts his mini golf thing and scolds him, gives him what for, and then he's like, I'm gonna be condescending and explain that I have a floating rock as a some sort of like one of those little desk things, like one of the balls that go back and forth, only it's just a floating rock. And
it's like the modern version of the little duck that dips in the water.
Yeah, exactly. It's Giovanni Ribisi's duck. But he explains this little floating rock thing again. This is ridiculous because we haven't even made it, what, 10 minutes into the film, and we've had voiceover saying that they need to mine this stupid stuff. And then he's like, yes, we need to mine this stupid stuff. And it's like, how, did you think we forgot from that point to that point what it was? I mean, there's plenty of things that you forget in this movie, but it's mostly character related because they're names of people and we're supposed to care about them and we don't. So whatever.
20 million a kilo.
It's not
20 million a kilo.
It's not difficult to grasp what it is that they want to do here at all, but we are treated to it being repeated over and over and over again. So they go ahead with the thing and they have him wake up and he's excited because he can run around. And so he knocks over some scientists and plays some basketball.
He's a very quick learner. He didn't even study. Mm-hmm. JP has done 500 something hours in the Matrix and he's done none. And he gets up and running and literally pretty quickly. And then he goes and eats a purple fruit.
Yeah, and this is why Cypher was so jealous of Neo. But, you know...
Well, Neo still missed his first jump.
That's true.
This is like a Neo that made his first jump.
Yeah, everybody misses the first jump.
Imagine how infuriating that would be. Not only did he make his first jump, he went out there and he ate a delicious steak fruit.
Yes, yes. It looks so glistening.
I thought it looked pretty good. I think the CG in this looks pretty good.
I'm going to be honest with you. There are shots in here that I really do not hate at all, and I think that are nice. But then there are other shots in here where I'm just like, I'm watching a video game, and I don't enjoy that feeling.
Yeah, do you want to have that tangent discussion now, or let's save that
for when we get to the second act, which is all video game.
I would just like to say that there are a lot of instances. I think the motion capture in this, which is obviously what they spend a lot of time and effort on, is actually really good in most instances. I mean, obviously there are some where it's there's less reason to put effort into it because it's a wider shot or whatever, and you can kind of tell a little bit. But I think that, and then a lot of the rendering and lighting is pretty good.
Well, the thing that bothers me about the motion capture is the fidelity of what they were able to get with the limbs and the torso is not really there. So there are a lot of shots in here where they're flopping around like rubber chickens. So
they put most of the effort into the face, and then it feels like the bodies are primarily post animated, not motion captured.
Which makes sense because they have an unusual scale. But the faces, they nailed curiously. They nailed the teeth and the smiles. You can instantly see that, and of course that helps that they had a camera in front of their mouths. And if you watch the behind the scenes, it makes total sense. But like that's the part where they did it. And as everybody says, the teeth are the doorway to the soul or whatever.
Is that what everybody says.
And you know, they did an okay job in a lot of these close up shots, especially of Neytiri, where she's, for some reason, I think there's like 10 shots in this movie where she is leaning up against a tree, and you see her in a close up, with like half of her face and like 3/4 light on her. There seem to be a few of those.
Right, like her first shot where you're looking through the foliage and she's sort of like standing up with her head cocked at like a 45 degree angle.
Yeah, and there are a lot of those where you can get some more detail in those close-ups, and you can appreciate the facial performance that Zoe Saldana did and that Weta captured, cleaned up, and I'm sure in some cases had to reanimate. But is something that you can appreciate. The more overt, larger movements that they make with running and jumping and fighting are less good-ish. But anyway, Grace has human clothes that are avatar-sized, which is an interesting novel choice. And she has her Sigourney Weaver face, so she seems very much like Sigourney Weaver. And then we haven't seen much of Sam Worthington, but he does kind of have a Sam Worthington face on his avatar as well. And what's his face looks like what's his face. So that's good. We can tie them all together and we won't get them confused with all the other blue people. And they go for their little sleep, and then they wake back up in the little tube things. They're going to start their thingy in the morning, and they hop on Michelle Rodriguez's helicopter thing and go fly into the jungle, which is great, I guess, because
they're gonna go do some preliminary exploration of the jungle or whatever. I don't know, some of the more interesting things I think about the avatar doodads are the scale against the humans, which you really only get in the very beginning there in that little like pod scene, and then at the end during the battle and stuff. But
yeah, when Neytiri is cradling dying Sam Worthington,
like when she busts into the little pod room or whatever that we've been seeing this whole time, and she's like gigantic, it's like, whoa, right, I forgot they were so big compared to the humans. And then she's like holding his head with her fist, just like clenching his skull. You could just like squeeze it and crush Sam Worthington's skull like a little purple fruit.
Look at this
image I just found on IMDb. This is a good looking rendered image. Tell me otherwise. I mean, I don't know. You have better eyes than I do, or whatever. But like, that's a good looking rendered image, isn't it?
Yeah. No. No. What Dan is referencing is in the in some of the fight stuff. What's his face has his gun thing, and you can see the muzzle flash lighting up his face, which is something that you don't even usually get in live action performances because they'll put that on a post.
I always add contact lighting when I do muzzle flashes because that's important for realism.
Mm-hmm. Well, but anyway, it's not bad. There are other things. I mean, I'm not going to heap a bunch of praise on this. Like I said, there's a lot of this movie that just feels like an interminable video game cutscene.
You mean rendering and story, or are you talking specifically rendering right now? Because I think story absolutely feels a lot like a cutscene.
I'm going to say some of these renders, particularly the creatures with smooth skin, the like.
Oh, like the slick demon monster dog thing that she rides?
The panther, jaguar, whatever, which we run into here when they start collecting root samples. And then, what's his name? Jake Sully? Sure. Sam Worthington's character wanders off and starts touching all the ferns. And the ferns all shrink up and he thinks that's hilarious until he gets the hammerhead rhino. And the hammerhead rhino, is unhappy. And then the hammerhead rhino backs off and it's like, oh, that's because I'm so great. And then it's the jaguar thing behind him over his shoulder.
Right. The jaguar thing has a little bit of a, like, it's dark, but it's also, it looks slick. Presumably because, like, I don't know, it's got a weird open mouth thing and it's like drooling or something, but it's also just smooth but slick.
Yeah, and the specular model for what they did is just, it's weird. Like it's very, like, I don't know, fongy. It's very strange.
It doesn't appear that it was meant to be shown in daylight. I think it looks like it was built to be looked at night,
which is strange because it has a daytime scene. Yeah,
it has a day fong and a night fong.
That's probably also due to the limitations of this movie at the time. This is, of course, a Render Man film, and Render Man is not at Render Man of this era. You could not really ray trace stuff like you can nowadays. They didn't have any real ray tracing infrastructure you would want to use on a motion picture. The priority was in their very sort of 1980s shader model that they had going on. Now they've basically totally changed what they're doing under the hood with RenderMan these days. But I don't even think Weta uses RenderMan anymore. They've got what's it called, Manuka or something like that. Starts with an M.
Oh, I don't know. Everyone's got their own proprietary thingamabob now.
Yeah, but I mean, you just look at your eight planets and compare it to this, and you know, it would be interesting to see what the new Avatar movie looks like just on a technical level, because I'm sure that they're going to be able to do so much more than what they were able to do in this one.
It's really important to wait for the technology to catch up to your vision before you decide to proceed with making a film.
No, because making the films also pushes the technology forward. But
this was the movie where he said all that stuff, right?
Well, I mean, everybody says that. George Lucas says that. Like, this is his Star Wars prequel. Like he wanted the technology to be there to tell the story. The problem is his story is garbage. So he could have done that, like a little polish on that when he was waiting for, you know, render farms or whatever. Like he I don't understand him. Like I don't know how you look at this even as like an animatic or storyboards or anything, and you're just like, yep, perfect. All it needs is a render button. Sad. So anyway, he fights the panthery thingamajig and then hops off a waterfall, and then he realizes that he shouldn't go chasing waterfalls because now he can't get back up to the platforms and the helicopters that he's used to. And this is a problem for him because he's alone in an alien
terrible.
Jungle.
That was terrible, but it was still more fun than a lot of this movie.
I was just gonna keep going until you stop me, but
until you start like wrapping the plot, what's her name does in that part of the song.
Oh no, thank you. And Dan is of course referring to the end title song, which many people, if you haven't watched it recently, might forget is even there. And then you're like, what is happening when those credits fire up? But there is the situation of Nightfall, and they can't find him, and he doesn't have thingies or whatever. I don't know. It's really contrived. Anyway, he's separated from them, and so they can't go looking for him, and he's on his own. And night sets, and he starts a fire because he somehow figured out that a certain plant has like kerosene sap or something. I don't know how he navigated that one.
He's a Marine. He's got resources.
Yeah, he's a Marine. He knows what you can set on fire. So he does, and he keeps the little tiny demon dog thingies away from him for a while. And then Neytiri, who's been watching him this whole entire time,
she's like, this guy's boring. I'm just going to kill him, and gets ready to shoot him with her bow. And then an AWA jellyfish lands on her arrow, and she's like, "Oh, I guess I shouldn't do that." And then she keeps watching. She protects him from the demon dog things or whatever.
Yeah, and she shoots one of them, and she's very upset at him for that.
Yeah, she kills a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, the one that she goes over and has to, like, you know, finish off.
Oh, yeah, it's injured or whatever, and she's got to put it down humanely.
Yeah, or novenely. But she's of course, Zoe Saldana doing a bit of an accent, and, of course, she has an understanding of the English language, a very fluent understanding of the English language because of Grace's school, which we don't see in the movie but is hinted at.
Yeah, in the one instance where the voiceover comes back like halfway through the second act for no reason, Grace didn't miss anything. She knows what she's doing. I have what she needs. Like, oh, God. Okay, voiceover off again.
Yeah.
Anywho.
Yeah, and so she does all that stuff, and then they put out the fire, and then
So, like, you should be sad. We had to kill all these, like, these beloved beings or whatever. And then he's like, fine. And she's like, go away. And he keeps following. And she's going to, like, hit him or whatever. But then he gets covered in AWA jellyfish. And he has no idea what they are. So he's, like, slapping at him. She's like, no, don't slap at it. It's God jellyfish.
Yeah, because they're the seeds of the tree.
Right. Sure. The floating seeds of the tree. And then they all land on him. And then they fly away. And he's like, all right, great. Mm-hmm. Why? And then Neytiri's like, you know what? Come with me. You can actually come along now, even though you were already coming along in the first place.
And then the jungle lights up because the fire is out, and so they see all the...
Oh, yeah. All you have to do is be one with nature and let the phosphorescent foliage light up your path or whatever. But
yeah, just let the Na'vi blacklight art guide your way.
Hmm. You think there's a tree that that makes like fuzzy Jimi Hendrix faces or whatever?
Probably not. But he's in tune with nature, and they run through on giant tree trunks and ponds and whatever. Like it's supposed to be a visual smorgasbord of stuff, and I'm sure it was much more impressive in 3D.
It was
watching it on,
which is also part of the reason why it's like incredibly oversaturated, because you know you need to pump up some of that stuff to make it work through the glasses.
Pump up the jam. You also have... this is also... You had referenced this earlier offline, but the weird lens choices that they made here, where it's just like big, wide angle, very kind of, I don't know, flat stuff.
Yeah. The whole movie kind of feels like a 24mm lens most of the time.
Yeah, it's a really... because I can understand how that would be immersive if you're watching this in 3D in a movie theater, but if you're watching this on, let's say, a 55-inch plasma television in a home viewing environment, it feels like nothing.
It feels very weird. Yeah, yeah, no, the wide angle serves to give you, it doesn't give you a realistic perspective for 3D, because obviously... for lens characteristics, something closer to a 50 is more like human vision, but it gives you a wider field of view, which gives you more sort of like a grand, vista look to your 3D, which, you know, is impressive to people. It kind of miniaturizes stuff, which is sort of what you want to do in the cinema environment, but it also keeps your depth of field nice and deep, so stuff's not incredibly out of focus, because you actually don't want stuff to be super out of focus in the background in 3D, so people can like look around and stuff, even though you get a little bit of depth of field stuff in this movie.
Yeah, depth of field flattens things, because it's all about the disparity, and there's less disparity when everything's just a blurry blob. So
yeah,
your eye can't pull anything out of that. So I've worked on 3D movies in the past where it was the 3D version of a 2D movie, and from a 2D art direction standpoint, they wanted to have the depth of field to separate the space and really like make it feel like there was depth. And then in 3D, you would do the same thing, open up the comp, and then just turn down the depth of field. Not completely removing it, but just reducing it so that you would see more detail in the background, and so that that way you would feel the depth back there in 3D space rather than just mushing out.
you primarily want to guide the eye with things like convergence and stuff like that, but you also use a little bit of depth of field to do the same thing.
Now, one thing I don't know, and maybe you know, is did they do a few of these shots differently for 2D from 3D, or was this all just treated as like left eye master kind of a thing?
That is a good question. I was looking through the technical specs briefly because when this fired up on my TV, it was 16:9. I was like, oh, is this another one of those things where HBO is forcing a 16:9? And there are three aspect ratios listed on IMDb. You got 16:9. You got 1.85 for 3D version constant with width, constant width venues. And then you've got 2.39:1 original theatrical release and 3D version constant height venues. So, I don't know what that means, but clearly there was some futzing with things, in the aspect ratio and the versioning here.
Yeah, but that could all have been cropping things in various ways.
Could be. But I know they did a little bit of, like, the vast majority of the 3D was beyond the screen plane. I know they brought things like the, when the, spoiler alert, when the tree falls down and there's all the ash and crap floating around, that stuff came out into the audience, but the vast majority of the stuff stayed pretty much around screen plane.
Yeah, well, you usually want to do that because when things get near the edge of the screen plane, and it breaks the illusion, because then it doesn't go...
Another reason most of these shots are like character dead center of frame, 24 millimeter lens, background moving around.
Yeah, because anything in the center of frame that's not breaking frame, you can pull out towards you. So it would be better to do it that way. But what I mean though, is like, was there anything that was recomposed, like actually delivered differently from Weta or ILM, to the client and then put in a certain version of the film? And I don't know the answer to that one.
I don't know the answer to that specifically either, but based on just like the way a lot of the shot composition feels kind of odd when watching it in 2D like this, I feel like they did not recompose things.
That is also my feeling as well, but I don't know, maybe there was like a few shots in here and it could
even dumber looking when it was in theaters. I don't know what to say.
Yeah. They do the thing where she takes him back to the elders. We get the scene that you described earlier where he's introduced to everybody and like the brother like wants to, I don't know, gut him right there. CCH Pounder.
He should have said, I'll take pleasure in gutting you, boy, and Navi.
Well, CCH Pounder as Moat, the Neytiri's mother and a spiritual leader, is like you said, all like, yeah, sure, whatever. Let's do the stuff. And Dad is easily persuaded to do the stuff, and so they start their long training montage of things where he goes to sleep in the hammock and he wakes up back at the base and they're not worried about him, but then he just starts learning all this stuff and
it's a montage, but it doesn't compress time in any useful way. It's still just as long. It's like there was a writer's room of people and they came up with a bulleted list of all of the things that would be cool to explore in this sort of world-building-ish way. And then they're like, great, how do we string all these together into a storyline? He's like, we'll just montage, a training montage, and it'll be like 40 minutes long. It'd be great.
Yeah. I mean, the only really relevant thing that you need to know in this montage is that their ponytails are not just an aesthetic choice. That they have these little fiber things that plug in basically to the other creatures on the planet, which also have the little fiber things. And they can basically control the other animals through that means. Like the horse thingies, anybody can ride any of the horses and they can interchange whoever's doing it. But apparently the flying things, the Ikron, they bond to one person for life, and then you got your floating inflamed rubber chicken, and that that one it can't really be ridden, or nobody does that, or whatever. It's hard. Blah blah blah.
Well, interestingly, the flying things mate for life with their humanoid Navi thing. Mm-hmm. But the Navi are allowed to have as many flying things as they want.
Yep.
Seems a little unfair.
No, I mean, you should really start some sort of campaign to redistribute the connections evenly across.
I'm just saying, whatever happened to the good old days of monogamy amongst flying dragon things?
Monaga dragon me? No, that doesn't work. We're not going to use that. But anyway, we also get some scenes in here with Sam Worthington in human form talking to Stephen Lang, Colonel Miles Quaritch. I don't know who said. Does anybody say his name? I have no idea. There's so many moments.
They call him Colonel every once or twice. That's
yeah, but they don't. Does anybody call him Miles Quaritch? I don't know.
Quaritch?
I mean, I'm sure they probably somebody does say it, but at the same time,
it's probably in the extended cut, the longer version of this movie.
With the 40 extra minutes of stuff that was cut out of this.
I missed it. Okay, there's one with an extra 9 minutes, and there's one with an extra 17 minutes.
There's also 40 minutes that I don't think they actually got to the stage that anything was fleshed out for all of those minutes, but it was apparently in an earlier assembled version of this.
Yeah,
James Cameron, not good at editing himself.
Right. The initial assembly of this movie was probably 6 hours long.
I mean, he used to be so much better at determining what was and wasn't important and removing it from a movie, but over time, and you can see this from his earlier films to his later films, the number of things that he would start out with before starting that elimination process crept up. And so eventually you're not bailing out enough water from the sinking boat. I think that is a situation here.
You don't think it's the case that, I think there are two reasons why this one ended up the way it was. I think partly is because when you start doing stereo 3D stuff, you get kind of lost in how cool some of the imagery can be, and you let some of that stuff slide by that probably should be cut out because it's fun to look at, which, again, you didn't look at in 3D, so I don't know if you have that opinion. But I think the other thing is, if you start scrutinizing like what stuff is relevant to a succinct story and what is not, this movie ends up being like 40 minutes long.
Yeah. There's just a lot of like really repetitive scenes too, with people saying like things like this scene with Stephen Lang as the Colonel, once again reiterating for the third or fourth time in the film so far that Sam Worthington needs to make friends with the Na'vi so that they can get them out of there and get the rock from underneath the tree. But I mean, how many times do they say that over and over again in this? And it's like,
yeah, the problem is though, they do all of these scenes so many times that you're watching it going, well, of course he's gonna betray them. He's gonna fall in love with the blue chick. He's gonna try and become a Na'vi full time. He's gonna take his hobby full time. But
his jobby
not
job.
Not only do they say it so many times that you see it coming, but at the same time, the motivation is still so thin that you're like, really? Is that really what you're
going to
do now?
Yeah, well, they're just saying what they're going to do over and over and over again. We're not, like you said, motivation is absent from this.
But like the falling in love with Neytiri, like you knew it was going to happen, but then when it happens, you're like, already? Really? Seriously? You're gonna forego your, I don't know, whatever, your like tribal stature sort of princesshood hooking up with the other guy to be with the new weirdo because you had some sort of bond with him during the training montage?
Yep. Well, you see, this is that kind of movie where that happens. And if you here's it's so annoying because it's like you see the instant you see her in this film, you know exactly what her character will amount to.
Ugly cry faces and falling in love with the main character.
Yeah, and having power and skill and capabilities that are overshadowed by her love interests towards the end of the film. And like we said, this is something that happens so much in film that you could really just shorthand it. Like, but for some reason, James Cameron is unaware of this bias that he has to tell this story and is also unaware that it is completely uninteresting to anyone watching it, that that he's not telling anything new or novel or original, and that what he's depicting does not constitute character development in any way. And his realization that occurs later on when he has to admit to things to Neytiri and being like, oh no, I was sent here to do this, but then I really fell in love with you. Like, oh wait, I'm sorry. Have we never seen that in cinema before now? Is that a new kind of excuse for this sort of behavior? Like,
and it's also glossed over too. She's like, you knew this would happen. And he's like, yeah. Like, he didn't even try to like talk his way out of it or anything. It's just like, yeah, oh yeah, I totally knew they were going to come blow up your tree thing. I just fell in love and got distracted or whatever. Like, yeah.
And her reaction to him is genuine. And believable in that when she rejects him and leaves him and skedaddles out of there when the tree is destroyed. But her accepting him is so just out of nowhere. Like, there's no explanation. He shows up with his red and flame chicken, and then everyone is like, you're the man. We must follow you. And yeah. I do not buy that. That's not, there is no story there. That is just, it's just this giant red chicken falls out of the sky, and then they're meant to be again. Like, that's,
well, and part of it's because, you know, like, he can memorize the words to appear to be like one of the crew, but then like he knows that this story is part of their culture and it's very important to them, and I think he sort of like believes his own BS about like whether or not he's able to bond with the big red rubber chicken. That means he is worthy or whatever. Like, the big red rubber chicken is Thor's hammer or something, and now suddenly he's respectable.
Yeah. Well, he knows that he needs to communicate to the Na'vi that they need to listen to him, otherwise things are going to be worse. But because, of course, he's a white man, so he knows best. But he can't convince them because he's been rejected. So the only way he can convince them is by manipulating them based on their belief system. And he knows that they believe that the red chicken is like such an important thing that if he were to fly the red chicken, then he would be all set.
I like that we're calling it the red chicken.
I mean, I forgot the name for it.
It's Rider of the Last Shadow or whatever.
Do you think anyone's listening to this and they're like, you're just not calling it the Rider of the Last Shadow? I'm so angry
you're
right now.
You're not calling it the Tetsutsutsutsuti thing.
The what?
I don't know. It's something like that. Yeah. It's like a four syllable thing with some T's.
Some apostrophes and some T's. Apostrophes.
Don't tease your apostrophes.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. And, you know, I'm not going to... I like that they went through the trouble to, okay, so to make a...
Sute is the dude. Oh. Sorry, you like that they went through the trouble of making the red chicken?
No, I like... ignore that. What I like is that they went through the trouble of making a fake language for this, and...
Oh, sure. Is it based on anything?
I don't know. I don't remember. I think it's, like, loosely based on a style of speaking, but it's supposed to be its own thing. But they...
It would have been great if they did the whole thing in Pig Latin. And just, like, completely seriously.
A.K. Ulisse. No, but... they... it was... I appreciate they went through that effort, but there's also a lot of made-up stuff for animal creature names that I'm not going to remember, and I'm going to wind up calling them the red chicken and the hammerhead rhino. It's nice that they went through that effort. Although, while we're talking about the subject of language, we should probably mention that this movie makes extensive use of the yellow papyrus garbage for subtitles.
Yeah, not only is papyrus the logo type, it is it is the subtitle font.
So angry.
So was angry. Was it necessary?
No, it was not necessary. I mean, not only is papyrus completely inappropriate for reading anything in a movie as a subtitle language to use at all, it is also not a is not a novel or interesting typeface to use to express anything artistically, because it's a default font that shipped with Microsoft Internet Explorer in like 1997 or whatever. Like, it's not, there is nothing special about papyrus. You can go to the grocery store and you're going to see signs for organic food that say whatever it is in papyrus, because papyrus has come to mean anything that has to do with the Southwest, or organic food, or anything exotic. All of a sudden, it's just in papyrus. And you can go to whatever restaurant or what have you at some venue, and you're going to see some line of papyrus somewhere. It is like a garbage font. It is bad, and it is in all kinds of bad places, and no one knows how to use it correctly, even if there was a correct use. No one has applied it to anything that they should have applied it to. You can go to the Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport, and there are papyrus signs for businesses, Dan, that are in papyrus. I've been to Ojai, and there are signs for coffee shops that use papyrus. Like, it is obscene the number of things that people are just like, you know what? I'm going to scroll through the 12 fonts that came with my computer, and that's the one I love, and then that winds up being the subtitle font that's used in this film, so that you're reading yellow text with jaggy edges and a flowy script-like nature. Like, it is completely wrong to use that in this situation, and I object to that wholly. And to think that there may be five movies with the ridiculous papyrus subtitles, because this is one of those creative decisions that James Cameron is never going to walk back or admit was wrong, and he's just gonna.
No, you don't think so? No. I think he would be willing to walk back the subtitles, but probably not the logo.
No, because he has had every opportunity since the home video release to replace the subtitles on this movie. The comp department.
Oh no, he's too busy to retcon something he's already made. But I think in the next version,
but he's already made, like, didn't he make the version that has like 9 more minutes or whatever? Like, if you're doing that kind of fiddly stuff, like, you just tell the people making the subtitles, hi, hello, you're gonna make this Helvetica now or something. Like, just something that you can just read that on screen and it's not bad. And I just, of course. Grabbed Helvetica just as a random example, but there are better subtitle fonts. Whatever. The point is, papyrus, bad. And James Cameron should not use it, but he will, because he's not going to ever admit that this was wrong.
The jaggy edges on the papyrus font probably looked really good in 3D.
Oh, God. Could you imagine if it was, like, beveled or embossed?
Yes, I can.
What if there was like a glinting highlight that went through the embossed edges and just sort of like glittered as it went over the crinkly surface? That would be just spectacular.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But anyway, there is, of course, before anybody sends us any more links, the Ryan Gosling SNL video where he is upset about papyrus, and there is a moment in there dedicated to Avatar.
So they fixed it. No, I think it looks pretty much the same. Oh boy. So getting back to Avatar, the video game cutscene. So much. I mean, when we say video game cutscene, I don't want it. I don't want to sound like I'm primarily saying that rendering is bad and it looks dumb or whatever. I would like the context of video game cutscene to be noted in this context as characters learning the rules of the video game that they're in, and then maybe like trying it out. Like, it's, they're kind of standing in the middle of the screen, and you're Jake Sully, and Neytiri is standing there looking at you saying, press A to jump, press B to jump on your flying thing. And then you do that. She says, great, now move on to the next thing. And then you go over there, and it's like, don't shoot the hippopotamuses, shoot the lizard things or whatever. And when you shoot a lizard thing, press C to pray to AWA or whatever. Like, I don't know. So much of it is just like learning the rules of Avatar. And then the only subtext to it is like, oh, look at all the time we're spending together. We're it makes sense that we're going to be bonded for life.
Yeah, I should also mention another component of this film that helps flesh out its world is James Horner's score, which if you go to the Animal Kingdom Pandora, World of Pandora or whatever, they have that playing on all the speakers. So you can just immerse yourself in the world of James Horner's score. He is not as self-plagiarizing in this particular one, although you still get some, like, I don't know, what is that, like a ball peen hammer on a on an anvil or something every now and then, the clanging. But he really tried to make his own version of The Lion King here. You get those soaring moments and the spiritual chanting and chorus components.
And the big drums and things, too.
Yeah, and the big drums. Gotta have big drums.
Somebody should have sang In the Jungle.
The Mighty Jungle.
Oh, boy.
The Avatar sleeps tonight. But, yeah.
Oh, the Avatar people just kind of fall down like Matrix people. You got JP falling down like a Matrix person.
It's so funny that they get dragged when Grace is like in her little harness thing they assembled to drag her.
Yeah, yeah, it's good. They liked her.
Yeah, well, but which is weird because Grace has done the least in preparing them for what will be coming. She has given them language skills, but she really hasn't done anything to help with their situation in terms of the threat that they're in. Sam Worthington is the one who talks Giovanni Ribisi into letting him go back inside to talk to them and tell them all the actual information about the attack that's coming. And Grace is just pleading, like, yeah, please listen to him. They're coming. It's going to be bad. And it's kind of a bummer because I feel like she should have a more forceful presence in what she's been doing there. She kind of doesn't.
The you would also think with all of the attempted sharing of knowledge between the two cultures that somebody would have introduced the Na'vi to the concept of firearms to the point that they would understand that firing arrows is insufficient.
Well, you see, Dan, firing arrows is insufficient for the first attack, which is when they don't win. But then firing arrows is effective in the second attack where they're supposed to win.
Right. So the key is to be flying your dragon downward. And then when you shoot the arrow, it has both the speed of the arrow and the speed of the flying downward dragon. So it's going double speed straight through the
glass.
That's
what they call a double dragon.
Also, he was in one of the bigger ships when they were shooting at him, and then later they were shooting at the little I don't know, the helicoptery fly looking things.
Yeah,
the Michelle Rodriguez mobiles.
Yeah, he's in his, like, I don't know, his overinflated Chinook helicopter. But the attack on the tree is just so ridiculous. And it's incredibly cartoonish. Like, the colonel is such a he's not a character at all. Like, he is a video game boss that you have to defeat, and he's just a ludicrously simple, transparently evil character that there's nothing going on here below the surface, except he doesn't like Pandora. He's racist, and he wants to kill all of the other people. And
yeah,
on the one,
his hobbies include bench pressing and, like, drinking gasoline.
Yeah, and swatting at fires that are on him. But he's giving everybody that you look at crazy eyes. He's a very intense person, sitting there drinking his coffee and talking about how they're gonna, you know, fire the gas, and then we're gonna, you know, that'll get them out of there, and then just start shooting it up, and then let's blow the columns. And it's obviously they're not out of there, so he's never cared really about not killing them. He's just sort of putting on some performative display of not killing them until he can just kill them outright.
Yeah, which is really weird. With as hard-headed of a bad guy as he is, he follows chain of command very specifically, including, but he reports to Giovanni Ribisi, apparently.
Well, because this is another one of James Cameron's completely original ideas, where there is a company that has
the company
influence on Marines, and
you got the people and you got the company.
Yeah, so Giovanni Ribisi's bad version of Paul Reiser is there. Not doing really anything to control the situation and just letting the colonel blow everything to kingdom come.
If Paul Reiser was in this movie, he would have slipped a facehugger alien inside of somebody's gas or their breathing apparatus, so when they go to put it on, it attaches itself to their face.
Yeah, I mean, Giovanni Ribisi, this part of the film is basically just there for reaction shots of him just sitting in his like command center with fires on the screens behind him. Like,
at least he's a little bit remorseful, might not be the right word, but he kind of realizes he's the head. He doesn't do anything to rectify his badness.
No.
He's just like, I want things and money and give me all the unobtainium. And then he's like, oh, I guess we're murdering lots of people. They're not really faceless savages that live in a tree.
But he doesn't say or do anything about that. He just has his reaction shot where he's just looking at the fires. So
can't uncrack that egg.
No, but he knows that the colonel wants to go, wipe out the rest of them, basically. When they have their satellites see that they're amassing a large number of them, a large number of Navi, and Giovanni Ribisi does not stand in the way of that at all or care, and he's just like, yeah, sure, and he commits even more force than was used to destroy the tree to this mission, including the evil shuttle.
I thought part of it was also that the Tree of Souls had a bunch of stuff underneath it that they wanted to.
Sure, everything has stuff underneath it.
All of the important landmarks are powered by unobtainium.
I mean, that's how they're magical landmarks. But they have the completely absurd part where they have the second attack, and it's just even more ridiculous and even more over the top. And that anyone would be following Stephen Lang's orders without question seems implausible.
Especially because what kind of insane human being holsters his weapon on the opposite side of his leg reversed? Like, how are you expecting to pull that out in any sort of efficient manner?
Well, I mean, he's more of a knife guy, but he's got
at least in the end there, he didn't say no more Mr. Knife Guy or whatever.
Oh.
Or Mr. Knife Mech or something.
Yeah. No, but it's ridiculous. The only person who's like, nope, screw this, is Michelle Rodriguez. And
I didn't sign up for this, man.
Yeah, and so she helps them out with stuff, and that's how they're able to get out of there and set up a new they're able to relocate one of their avatar trailers, they're able to commit to helping the Navi with this, and this is where the red inflamed rubber chicken comes in, and Jake tells them that they need to go on the offensive and recruit all the other clans, and so there's a montage of them recruiting the other clans, and this is the, you know, they've amassed all these people in the last day, so we gotta really, like, take care of them and wipe them out so badly that they never think to amass again or something. It's a really... There's not much logic to it. He just wants to kill everybody. And so that's his plan, and they're gonna bomb the tree with pallets of explosives that will be dropped from the back of the evil shuttle. And the avatar people are all organized against this, and they've got the all the Ikran flying things, and they got all the horse stuff, and the humans, for whatever reason, drop ground infantry. If your plan is to blow everything up from the altitude, why would you put any people on the ground? It doesn't make any sense. But they do that, and this, of course, leads to fighting and stuff where they don't shoot at the horses until they're like point blank range, because I guess they need to preserve their ammo and their automatic weapons, whatever, it's dramatic, I suppose. And you get the Ikrons all slicing and dicing the helicopters by sort of clutching onto the tails and then whacking them into the floating rocks. And Colonel Evil Guy is all upset about all this stuff, and they're all shooting at things, and it looks like they're going to lose, and then Michelle Rodriguez pops up and then, you know, nails him, and then they nail her, and then she dies, and stuff, and then they have all the things with the blah, blah. Ugh, it just goes on forever. They eventually get to the point
she's
where
they... She's got plenty of time when she's crashing to give a message like, go down. Sorry, Jake. Like, you expect her to be like, tell my parents I did good. Tell them I love them, and I won't be at the family farm to help this year, but I'll miss them all dearly.
Tell them back home that I had character development, and I turned from somebody who was an indifferent Marine to somebody who cared about doing the right thing.
Tell Pa I died brave, and I did good.
So ridiculous. But they have... They blow up the evil space shuttle by putting grenades in it, and then they start to do the same to the evil giant helicopter, but he gets knocked off and stuff, and then they, you know, just have an explosion that sort of makes it kind of fall, and then Jake falls to the ground, and Tiri has bonded with one of the panther thingies, because Awa... Awa doesn't take sides, Jake. Awa took sides, and
Awa was just like accidentally slept in that morning or something, and wasn't there for the beginning of the battle.
Yeah, this is Awa ex machina here, because they wait until a lot of them started to die, and then all of a sudden nature attacks, and the hammerhead rhinos and things and all kinds of stuff, chaos occurs, and. A bunch of wild Ikrin who have no riders destroy all the rest of the helicopters. I think they call them scorpions or something.
Yeah, because you do kind of forget, like, in the beginning of this movie, they're like, oh, every little bit of nature wants to kill you. And then that first scene where they land, they're like, oh, yeah, you could die pretty quickly here. And then that kind of goes away for the rest of the movie until the very end, where you're like, right, this is a very dense forest full of very violent animals that want to kill people from the outside. So...
Yeah, well, that's because we've spent the second act of this film on what a peaceful, wonderful place this is.
Right, you get your floating rocks, you got your pair bonding with your dragon things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they, Neytiri, battles with the colonel in his mech suit, and she gives him, opens up a can of whoop butt on him. Except he still plunges a knife into her jaguar thing, so she doesn't have that anymore. And she's pinned underneath the weight of the dead jaguar thing. And this is when Jake has to fight him, and they duke it out with stuff until he's going to die, but then not before he kills him first, and then not before you kill me, I'm going to kill you, but you don't know that I'm going to kill you before you kill me. Anyway, There is eventually a death that occurs from this process, after a lot of clanging about. Stephen Lang, as this colonel, like we said, this makes no sense at this point in the operation. What he's doing is just pure evil, has no connection to any sort of military tactics or motivation behind what their mission is or anything.
And it's great that he goes, like, how does it feel to betray your race? And Jake's response is to hiss at him. But it's like, what? Are we supposed to get something from that? He's not... Are we supposed to think that he's actually betraying his race? Or are we supposed to... Like, why is this here?
Because the only reason it's there is because the only thing that motivates... the colonel is just crazy racism. Crazy space racism is the only thing that motivates him. I'm sorry, crazy racism, because I'm sure he's probably a racist on Earth, too. He seems like the type, just based on his disposition and his evilness about basically like every facet of his life. But it's absurd, because there's no reason for him to do any of the stuff that he's doing in the mech that he's with his giant knife. Because the best way to equip a giant robot is to give it an enormous Bowie knife, because you never know when it's going to have to...
But Natsiri broke it.
Yeah, but why does it have a giant knife? Does it have to clear trees?
Maybe.
Okay, I think it's silly.
Destroyed thing.
I think it's just a really silly thing, so that way they can have a knife fight, you know?
Sure.
You brought a Na'vi to a knife fight, but, you know, Jake, the colonel blows the glass on the little camper, so that sucks the oxygen out, and the Na'vi version of Jake goes offline because of that, Natiri is all concerned and doesn't know what's going on, and for some reason hasn't determined that the camper is there, or I don't know if they really had a talk about all of the how this works, really. But
had a talk about the birds and the bees and the brain links.
Yeah, apparently not. But she eventually figures out something's gone on. She gets in there and she sees the face mask and puts it on him. Because she's intuited from seeing Grace in the face mask earlier that they need face masks, I assume.
Stephen Lang had one on because he had to eject his cracked mech windshield.
Yeah, but she gave him two nice big old arrows right through his chest. It was a lot of fun. Besides, Stephen Lang doesn't need your air, as determined by an earlier scene where he blew the hatch on the command center.
I mean, that's kind of like, it's kind of a cool dramatic character moment for him, but he's still like, you need to do something else. Otherwise, he's just ridiculous.
He's ridiculous.
Cartoon character. But it does show like his just contempt and rage at the idea that anyone would do anything other than follow his orders and kill the indigenous. He's so angry that he's going to kick the door open and break the airlock. Just so he can start shooting at people. He's just going to hold his breath because, like, screw you guys.
Yeah.
He's so mad at them, he's going to risk his own life to kill them.
Yeah. But he does die, finally. And Jake lives, and presumably they can patch that up and get him reconnected back to the Avatar stuff. They escort all the peeps out of there from the base back to the other evil shuttle that wasn't destroyed, and all the humans have to go except for a couple that stay behind, which were the ones that helped, who didn't die.
How do the Na'vi know that they don't just get on the spaceship and fly to the other side of the planet, land again?
No way of knowing. Although maybe they got control of the base stuff and presumably satellite uplink, but who could trust that? I don't know.
Unless they put a Na'vi on the spaceship to fly him out of there.
Probably not, but...
probably not, no.
Yeah, no, it's... This movie's also very... Like, I don't know... They're going to come back, presumably, in the second movie. They're going to be like, we need rocks. So we're going to come in with more guns and stuff and get more rocks, I guess, is going to be what happens. I have no idea. But I assume there will be humans returning for some reason. All these humans are booted, and Giovanni Ribisi is very sad. He's got a sad face because he failed at his mission, and he's going back, and that's because things got out of his control, and he did basically nothing for most of the film, except his little speech at the beginning where he talked about how much he liked rocks.
Unobtainium.
You know, and that is a major sticking point for some people, is that it's called unobtainium. I mean, we have really ridiculously named metals and rocks and things in our era, so I guess I could. I'm not as hung up on that particular part of it, but I'm hung up on is just like all of the messaging around like how they need to get it and how it's only from under this tree and there's like an entire planet. But they don't seem to care about that. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense. They gotta strip mine it. They're ridiculous cartoon characters in a weird eco drama about James Cameron's fantasies about how he wants to save the day. I guess it's very strange. Like, I don't know how else to ascribe what goes on in this movie than James Cameron thinks is really cool, because it doesn't It doesn't seem to like help the world that we live in.
It's This whole movie is just a big world building sandbox that he got to play around in and explore. And he tried a lot of things, didn't go particularly deep on any of them, but he did a lot of stuff, and he invented a world so deep that it is clearly capable of being a franchise / theme park. So, you know, he put in some work and it paid some dividends.
I mean, this movie has made a lot of money.
A lot of money.
Yeah, a lot of money. More than it should have. It also cost an enormous amount of money to make. It was $237 million to make it.
It'll be cheaper to do the next one.
Yeah, plus $9 million for the re-release. And the box office on it was $2.788 billion.
That is insane. I guess if it weren't for the inflated Stereo 3D ticket cost, it probably would only be like $700 million.
I mean, I don't know. I haven't even done the math on that one. But
I was being stupid.
This movie is basically, I think, widely known for being the spectacle that it is, and people watched it and had a visual appreciation for it, as you said you did when you watched it in the theater. But as a home media thinker's movie, not for me.
It doesn't really hold up super well on the small 2D screen. Especially my small 2D screen, which like my LCD on my TV is still going out because I haven't fixed or replaced it yet. So it's just like kind of flickery and bad looking.
Yeah, it looks fine on my plasma, but I do still want to eventually get the UHD thing. Maybe it looks even better in 4K HDR.
It'll look great. You got that tight shutter. You got that deep depth of field. It'll look so real. It'll be like a piece of paper where James Cameron had personally come to your house and drawn a frame of Navi on your TV.
Yeah. Well, and then to make it feel really real, I'll turn on motion smoothing.
Oh, Jesus. That would make me vomit.
No. This movie, what a mess. And the movie, of course, ends with the successful memory transfer, mind transfer of Jake from his human body to his Navi body.
Yeah, it didn't work for Grace because she was too weak because she was shot or whatever. But Jake is a strong leader who was chosen by Awa by the floating jellyfish in the beginning of the movie. So he can pass through the eye of Awa and come out the other side and be I don't know.
Yeah.
Reborn. It's his birthday.
Yep.
You think he's going to have a funeral for his other body, too? Or is he just going to leave it, like, permanently in the link? it wasn't in the link, sorry, because was actually physically present.
Yeah, it was covered in all those little weird tree fibers.
Oh, God, the tree bits that they put around Sigourney Weaver to make it look like they wrapped her in leaves, but really it's just like a leotard with some leaves in strategic places.
It was so bad. I don't know why they had to make her naked for this. I assume James Cameron is like, oh, she needs to be naked so that there's increased skin contact because they don't have the port in the back of the head. I'm assuming that's the reason behind that, because she had clothes prior to that. But yeah, that's weird. Although she was right. It did mess up her day. But
God.
Can you believe that this movie came out in 2009?
I don't know what to believe anymore. 9 years ago. I mean, James Cameron makes a habit of waiting a fair amount of time between sequels when he does them, so.
Well, it's going to be December 18th, 2020 before Avatar 2 is released.
Mm. What was the time gap between the Terminators is?
It was what, 1984, 1990. I don't actually know.
I'm clicking, I'm scrolling.
1984 and 1991, so that was not that long. 7 years.
Avatar. Film 3, filming, 4 and 5, pre-production.
11 years in the making.
Boy. Mm-hmm. 2020. Oh, 3 is coming out 2021. They're going to kick that one out quick. And then 4 and 5 are 2024 and 2025.
Yeah, well, that's because they haven't made those. Because yeah. They're going to wait and see how the second and third one
by then anyway.
Yeah. Oh, man. Could you imagine if it was like your lifelong ambition to see the second and third Avatar movie and they just kept getting pushed back?
Was my lifelong goal, my bucket list ambition?
weren't there news stories about people who were depressed after seeing Avatar, that the real world wasn't as vibrant and that they couldn't enjoy it or whatever? Wasn't there like some depression linked to longing to be in the world of Avatar? I think I remember
it's
some
probably the
BS.
Same people who like play The Sims so long that they fall in love with their character and then are sad because they can't go live inside The Sims. Or second life or whatever.
I just can't imagine being in love with this movie that much to have those feelings.
I mean, there's the people who saw Titanic 20 times or whatever. Like,
oh, well, that's a different thing. That's not wanting to be in the world of Titanic. You didn't want to.
It's a different.
You didn't
want to
be in the
illusion.
Icy water, trying to balance yourself on top of a wooden board and being like, oh, there's no room for Jack. Like that. Nobody was aspiring to do that.
I don't know. I think some people wanted to feel love so strong that they would throw away a giant diamond or whatever.
Near far, wherever you are, that's how you know. Yep.
Anyway, I don't know that I have anything else.
No.
I'm shocked we spent this much time talking about this movie because there's not that much in it.
No, there's no there, as they say.
There are no hats to put on top of other hats. This movie is woefully hatless.
Well, I mean, with those ears, it's hard to like find a good hat for the Na'vi, I would assume.
You got to make sure it's a snapback, so you got room for your ponytail.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also not a ponytail, because it's got wiggly bits inside of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which version of the movie is the one that has... Grandma's boy JP holding the giant shoe that his avatar wears that I sent you the photo of.
Oh, I have no idea. That might just be a behind the scenes photo?
I don't think so.
Okay, I don't know. I didn't see that.
See, I mean, it's not in the movie, so I'm wondering what version it's in.
It might not be in any of the versions. It might be cut.
It's probably pretty good.
Yeah. Should be. I'm sure it was in a very interesting shoe scene that you've been deprived of.
Look how big these shoes are. Our avatars are so tall. I wish I was a little bit taller.
You wish we were a baller?
They do play basketball in this movie, too.
They do play basketball. Although it seems a little unfair, given the height advantage.
How thrilled would Skilo be if he could be an avatar?
I don't know. Who's Skilo?
The guy who said that song.
Oh, I just did the song.
Oh my god.
Hello? I wish I was a little bit taller. I wish I was a baller. I wish I had a girl who looked good, I would call her. Wish I had a rabbit in a hat with a bat and a 6-4 baller. I wish I was like 6'9", so I could get with Leoshi, cause she don't know me, but yo, she's really fine. You know, I see her all the time, everywhere I go, and even in my dreams, I can scheme a way to make her mine. Cause I know she's living fat, her boyfriend's tall, and he plays ball, so how am I gonna compete with that? Cause when it comes to playing basketball, I'm always last to be picked, and in some cases, never picked at all. So I just lean up on the wall, or sit up in the bleachers.